This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They find it within themselves to have the courage of their conviction and their scientific findings to carry on all these years.
Since 1973, the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement has been bestowed upon people who've made a significant impact in the fight for a sustainable planet. Last week on Sea Change Radio, we spoke with noted activist climate scientist Michael Mann, who was one of two recipients of this year's Tyler Prize. This week, we're honored to speak with the other Tyler Prize laureate, Warren Washington, to learn about the beginnings of his groundbreaking career as an atmospheric scientist. Dr. Washington was the second African-American to receive a PhD in meteorology. He's a former chair of the National Science Board and currently a senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. After our conversation with Dr. Washington, we chat with this year's Tyler Prize panel moderator, Kelly Sims Gallagher, a professor at the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy, about the evolving intersection of global affairs and climate science. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kelly Sims Gallagher. She is a professor at the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy in Medford, Mass. Kelly, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
It's great to be here.
As a Fletcher alum, I was delighted to see that the school has begun to take climate change very seriously and has added a lot to the curriculum. Why don't you first take a step back and explain what the Fletcher School is and what your team's mission is?
Well, the Fletcher School is a school of global affairs, and we were founded after World War I with the hope of trying to promote peace and prosperity throughout the world. Our roots are very much in international law and international diplomacy and trying to find diplomatic solutions to conflict. But of course, over the many decades since that founding period, many new issues have come to the fore. Including issues related to sustainable development, gender studies, conflict resolution. And so Fletcher has grown, of course, with the times. And we now have very rich and deep programs and in international environment and resource policy, development, conflict resolution, security studies, and so forth.
And you're here in San Francisco this week to discuss climate change and geopolitics and how they all intersect. Why don't you kind of give a brief overview of this conference, if you can, and the Tyler Prize laureates, what they're all about.
Yes. So I serve on the selection committee for the Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement, which is probably the premier prize given. It was intended to be the Nobel Prize for the environment. And this year, our two laureates are Michael Mann and Warren Washington, both of whom made significant contributions to climate science, but both of whom also made very important contributions to public understanding about the issue of climate change. Warren Washington was one of the first to develop global climate circulation models, gave us the ability to forecast into the future. Michael Mann has been one of the most outspoken, you can almost say activist scientists who have been trying to communicate the gravity of the science of climate change to the general public. He's worked on children's books and is active on Twitter, and that's something that's very unusual and uncomfortable for most natural scientists to do.
And since you and I went to the Fletcher School in the 90s, which was much more politics, diplomacy, international law, economics, business, media, these kind of areas. But environment and the climate was not really on the radar. That's shifted quite a bit, not just at the Fletcher School, but a lot of political science, history,
schools across the country. Why don't you talk about the revolution that's been underway in education over the last decade?
So most of the schools of international affairs, like the Fletcher School, came to the environmental issue after the Earth Summit in Rio in 1992. So actually at Fletcher, that same year, we founded the Center for International Environment and Resource Policy. So we were one of the first to establish a research center that was devoted to the issues of global sustainability. Most of the other schools now have, you know, fairly strong programs in environment and resource policy. Of course, you know, the real challenge is how you reconcile environment and development. And I think one of the areas that Fletcher is particularly strong is having a very strong program in development economics and development studies, combined with this focus on environment and resource policy. And in fact, our center is co-directed by myself, who works primarily on policy, environmental policy, and Jenny Aker, who is a development economist with a lot of focus in Africa. And our fields of study have also evolved in this way. So we have a formal field of study at Fletcher in environment and resource policy, and we have one in development economics. And these are very popular to combine. The nice thing also is you can combine a field like environment and resource policy with security studies and be looking at the connections between environmental degradation and conflict, or migration as another example.
And as the panel discussion moderator, what do you want to know most from these great minds, Warren Washington and Michael Mann, scientists who study climate change in a very different way than what you and your colleagues at the Fletcher School study? What do you want to pull out of it to inform your studies?
What really stands out to me about these two individuals is the exceptional courage that the two of them have displayed over the years in very different ways. Warren Washington was the first African-American atmospheric chemist, and he was the first one to put together these models. And of course, these models were very controversial in the early years because they were showing that we had significant climate disruption in our future. And of course, that was a reality that many people didn't want to accept. In the case of Michael Mann, he's really well known for this graph that really showed human attribution. In other words, the fact that human emissions of greenhouse gases from the combustion of fossil fuels were the main cause of global climate change, that it wasn't a natural phenomenon. And he was a lead author of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and that big report that determined that there was this attribution of fossil fuel combustion for climate change. And he came under vicious attack. And some of the scientists, you know, really wilted under all this pressure, withdrew from science, maybe left their academic positions altogether. And Mike found it within himself to stand up and defend, you know, not only his own work, but the work of the whole Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so to me, the two of them just have displayed extraordinary courage in the face of a lot of pressure. And so I'm most interested in hearing from them, how did they find it within themselves to have the courage of their conviction and their scientific findings to carry on all these years?
Is there pressure within the international affairs community to cover both sides of the issue all the time? You know, those 1-2% of the fossil fuel scientists who don't want to acknowledge the realities of climate change. Have you ever had any pressure like that, or any of your colleagues, are you aware of them having that kind of
problem? So it's interesting that the controversy about climate science is a uniquely American phenomenon. And so that's why it's all the more important to have American scientists speaking up for the science. But in the international affairs arena, the controversies are much more about who bears responsibility for the problem, who should have the steepest emissions reductions, who should pay to help, you know, vulnerable countries cope with the consequences of climate change. And so although the pressures are different, they are very strong. And I have worked at the intersection of the United States and China. And of course, we America have often blamed China as being a major emitter and an excuse for us not to take more action. And conversely, China looks at the United States, up until recently the largest emitter of greenhouse gases and definitely a much richer country. And China has said that the United States bears the most responsibility for trying to reduce emissions. So this impasse between the two countries has been a persistent problem. And I was fortunate to be able to help negotiate the U.S.-China climate agreement in 2014, which broke through that impasse. But I would say I feel a lot of, often feel a lot of pressure and controversy about, is China upholding its commitments? Can we trust China to do this? This kind of, these different pressures can be challenging to cope with.
Can China be an important partner in trying to address the problems of non-renewable energy in vulnerable populations in sub-Saharan Africa, in areas where we've seen 100 years of industrialization in countries like US and China, where we've kind of been able to enjoy the benefits, if you will, of cheap fossil fuel energy, and now we're saying to them, you can't kind of join us on this journey of industrialization. Could you kind of give us a snapshot of how the Chinese view this same issue? Because it's one that we grapple with a lot on Sea Change Radio.
Well, I think the first point to make is that China has fully accepted the science of climate change, and it has said that even though President Trump announced he intended to withdraw the United States from the Paris Agreement, it would stay the course. So China's definitely staying in, and so far it's on track to achieving its commitments. In fact, it looks like it'll achieve its peaking commitment early, which is great news. The big concern I have about China is actually how it is funding energy infrastructure overseas. So while China is making tremendous progress in starting to manage emissions domestically, it is at the same time supporting the construction of a lot of coal-fired power plants in developing countries through its Belt and Road Initiative. This doesn't necessarily represent a leakage, because China domestically is really turning to renewables and to nuclear, and it has very ambitious non-fossil targets. But it is doing, through its development finance, some potential damage, because every single new coal-fired power plant that's constructed in Southeast Asia or Africa is going to last for 50 to 75 years. So I think China has an important responsibility to help these developing countries identify and examine and understand cleaner alternatives. And China itself is going through this transition right now. So it actually has a lot to teach these developing countries about how to do that.
She's a professor at the Fletcher School of International Law and Diplomacy, Kelly Sims Gallagher. Professor Gallagher, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It was great to be here.
Everybody, let's sing, let freedom ring, let it ring, let it ring. We got the all bitches. Do our thing, make a better world to live. Yeah, 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 yeah. Sing, 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 sing. Yeah. We got to all pitch in. We got to do our thing. Got to make a better world to live. You know we got to all pitch in. Do our thing. Make a better world to live.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Warren Washington. He's a distinguished scholar at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Dr. Washington, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you.
Congratulations on receiving the Tyler Prize. It's quite an honor. So you were the second African-American to receive a PhD in meteorology. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why don't you explain how you got into the field and what it meant being an African-American in Jim Crow America when you received your doctorate? What kind of challenges did you feel you had to overcome?
Well, I want to say a little bit first about my parents. My father graduated from a black school in Alabama, and its name is Talladega. And my mother went to University of Oregon. My parents encouraged me to get a college education. I had a great interest as a child in science. So I wanted to go to a school that had a physics program, and I wanted to be a physicist. And that's what I graduated in a bachelor's in physics. Then I started working on a master's, and turned out that a meteorologist was part of the department at the Oregon State University. And I worked as a radar operator, taking measurements from a mountain in Oregon, and I got more interested in meteorology. So I graduated with a master's degree in 1960. And in 1959, on a small group of scientists was working on trying to build a computer model of the atmosphere at Stanford Research Institute in Palo Alto, California. And they were looking for somebody who had a good mathematics background to come help do some of the calculations. So I got the opportunity to go to spending the summer in 59 with them. And at the end of the summer, I thought it was exciting that they were showing on the way to build the computer models.
And this was all white men, basically,
that's
that were
true.
Running this thing.
And
or were there women in the group?
Oh, in the group, it was all men.
All white?
All white. And I then ended up going to Penn State University in July of 1960. And it was a good experience for me because the faculty was very supportive of some of my ideas on building computer models and being able to analyze data on computers. And I ended up, after 3 years, I got my PhD, and I was looking for a place to begin my career. And openings became available at the newly opened National Center for Atmospheric Research, and I joined in September of 1963. As far as I know, I was the only African-American to be hired at that time, and certainly I was the second African-American to get a PhD.
And we've done several pieces on Sea Change Radio about the lack of diversity in the environmental movement. Maybe you can speak to the evolution you've seen, whether you find it encouraging or disheartening, in terms of diversity within atmospheric sciences and in the science community at large.
Well, there were two aspects that had to be dealt with. We had, even in the 1960s and 1970s, we found that there was very few women in the field, but also African Americans, Hispanics, and Native Americans. So I spent a little bit of time visiting many of these pockets of where they had some students going to the schools in the southeast part of the U.S. in Atlanta, Jackson State, Alabama, and places like that. And I would meet some of these kids, and I would encourage them to look at science of the atmosphere and the oceans and other parts of the climate system to explore getting advanced degrees. I told them basically that they could do a lot better if they had higher degrees than just having bachelor's. The help of the American Meteorological Society, which has the forecasters as well as the researchers in atmospheric science, became interested and wanted to increase the number of underrepresented minorities and women. And I headed up a effort which has now increased the representation of these underrepresented groups. And at the time that I first became active in 1970s, it was only two or three of us at the meetings, of the annual meetings. And now when we have an annual meeting, there can be well over 100 African Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans. And the women, our population has grown enormously. It's up to almost 40 or 50% in many of the graduate school programs of over 100 universities. So you can see a change was taking place.
Yes, stars shining bright above you. Night breezes sing to whisper I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore trees. Dream a little dream of me, yes. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you miss me. While I'm alone, can be, dream a little dream of me.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with Dr. Warren Washington, who is an atmospheric scientist and one of the recipients of this year's Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement. So you've been appointed by six different presidents in your career to different posts. That's and a wide ranging. Maybe you can kind of give us a little bit more of a snapshot of some of your service.
Well, okay. On the first president that I had a presidential appointment with was Jimmy Carter, and he had as part of his advisory mechanism something called the National Committee of Oceans and Atmospheres. And it had to deal with fisheries research and the atmosphere and the oceans and so forth. And it gave advice mostly to NOAA, but also other science agencies. And it turned out at the end of my four-year term, I was reappointed for another term. So I served under President Reagan. Then I served as an advisor for the first President Bush, and then Clinton. Now, the Clinton one was an interesting one. I was appointed to the National Research Board, and it gave advice to the National Science Foundation, and I became chair of the National Science Board and served under the second President Bush. Obama, I gave advice to through the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering and Medicine. So I've worked with giving advice on so many different subjects, all the way from radars to ocean measurements to fisheries to air quality. So I feel I've touched base with not only people in my field, but many different fields of human factors.
Do you think that your chosen field of research has given you the ability to kind of stay above the political wranglings that accompany climate change? I mean, you've worked for all the presidents up through Obama, starting with Jimmy Carter. So three Democrats, three Republicans. Is it more of a function of your field of study or something else?
Well, I think it was our first desire was to try to build a model, a computer model of the atmosphere and then the ocean and then sea ice and then all the way to looking at the biological aspects, vegetation, and so forth. So on the idea was to build a model that could be used for a whole bunch of different issues, looking at past climates and future climate. And somewhere in the time period of 1987, the Department of Energy became interested in what we were doing and wanted to help sponsor some use of the Department of Energy computers, supercomputers, on issues dealing with climate change. And so we joined with them as well as the National Science Foundation to start carrying out experiments on what happens when you increase carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And that's always been part of our research. It was to first of all, build a model that is credible and as accurate as we could get it in those days. So, and with the limitations on computer capabilities, to use it to answer policy questions as well as legitimate research issues.
Dr. Warren Washington, thank you so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for interviewing me, and hopefully you can help convince people that climate change is a serious and important issue.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Albert Collins, James Booker, and Louis Armstrong. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.